starte. Mitt navn er Petter Reinholdsen, og jeg er leder i foreningen NUG. Hjertelig velkommen til våre månedlige medlemsmøte. Ting å si før vi kommer godt i gang. Vi drar etter møtet på en dertil egnet plass, antagelig Bear Palace eller noe der omkring, for å sosialisere oss etter møtet. Så sleng dere gjerne med på det. Og NUG har en prisutdeling for fremme av fri programvare om litt over en måned, som nå er inne i en periode med å ta imot nominasjoner. Så hvis dere har noen folk dere vet burde nevnes i prissammenheng, så husk å sende inn en nominasjon. Nok om det. I dag har jeg vært så heldig å få et ganske ekte sleppfest anledning, eller release party som det heter på godt norsk. Og vi har da fått jeg tror det er liksom sjefen for det hele, som har passet på at alt har gått bra. Anders Berg fra Vegnett, som står der og smiler i bakgrunnen. Og Paul Henning Kamp, en kjent Tribeste-utvikler som har stått for mye av det utviklingsjobben. På besøk for å fortelle hva i verden det de har gjort for å få VG til å bli en akseptabel nettavis.
Ja, ikke noe med innholdet dere.
Da gir jeg ordet til Anders Berg, da begynner vi.
Ja, velkommen hit i dag til Release Party. Ja, jeg kan jo si, egentlig skulle vi hatt noen ekte varnish-skjorter her i dag, men den ble litt forsinket. Så når jeg kan, første runde på øl, den på VG, jeg tror. Kan jeg i hvert fall love.
Yeah!
Jeg heter Anders Berg, jeg er teknisk ansvarlig for VG-nett, og har vært det siden VG-nett var en Silicon Graphics indie-maskin, og vi satt på en 10 megabit-linje som ikke var fullduplex engang. Så det er den introduksjonen der. Og som Ron Atkinson sier i en sketch, hvor han er brudens far: "Now is the time for the sucker who paid for this all to speak his mind." Velkommen til Varnish. Varnish er en HTTP-akselerator som VG og i samarbeid med Limpro har utviklet det siste året. Det vil si at tanken begynte for ett år siden av meg. og vi begynte utviklingen i mars i år. Ja, så det er fortsatt litt ung kode, men mye har blitt gjort på den tiden. Og Paul Henning vil snakke mye mer om de tekniske detaljene rundt det. Målsetningen med prosjektet var jo å lage en god HTTP-akselerator som kunne konkurrere med de alternativene som er i open source-verden i dag. Jeg vet ikke hvor mange av dere her som bruker Squid, hvis dere jobber med web-akselering, ja. Den har sine mangler, og det var en av de tingene vi ville rette på med Varnish. En annen omsetning var jo å utnytte moderne hardware-arkitektur og maskinvare, som på den enden vet jeg skal snakke om, for å oppnå bedre ytelse. Og du kommer til å snakke om ytelsestall etterpå, ja. Da er jeg veldig glad å kunne introdusere Paul Henning, som skal snakke litt teknisk om hva vi gjør for noe med akseleratoren vår. Følg med, han er en dyktig kar.
Takk.
I'll do it in English, because I think if I do it in Danish, I would get very enthusiastic and you won't understand a word of what I'm saying. If I do it in English, I'm a bit handicapped and you're a bit handicapped, and I think it will kind of even out. Content management systems are a problem. When you send a HTTP request to a content management system, it will go into its database, pick out a couple of hundred items, sort through them, decide what ads to show you, da da da, and come up with an HTML page. If your web browser thinks it has an up-to-date copy, it will only send a head request or a if modified since request, and the content management system will do exactly the same thing and throw the result away, telling you it's all the same. Content management system needs some kind of caching in front of them. Content management systems are slow because they have a very complex content generation model. There's no way you can escape this. There's graphical designers who want the colors to match the color of the picture of the queen's dress or whatever. There, you have to select the right ads, you have to have the new news, you have to have the relevant news, and so on. And it's very hard to scale content management systems from one machine, because it's all in the database. You can put multiple machines in front of it, but in the end, you end up with a database running on some piece of hardware. And that will be your performance limiting factor. Nobody in the media business can afford the sort of Oracle database they need to get the performance to run directly on their content management system. So there's some need for a server-side caching, and right now you have Apache, you have Squid, and you can pay somebody through your nose. Apache as a cache, there's a mod cache and a mod proxy module you can use for Apache, and that's kind of neat, but it's not what Apache is built for. Apache does a decent job, but it is a square peg round hole situation. You're trying to use a web server as a cache, and it has a really lousy interface to the backend server. There's many shortcomings of this. One of them is you have practically no control over your content at the cache level. That's kind of interesting. Squid is a cache, but it's built for client-side caching, which means it has a lot of stuff we do not need. It can do proxying for FTP requests. We don't care. It can do proxy authentication. We don't care either. It has a sort of 1970s, 1980s software design, which means performance sucks. It's fragile and buggy. I think that's mostly a software maintenance problem, but doesn't help you if you're trying to run a web service. It has the wrong configuration features. It's built to sit somewhere out at the far end of a thin pipe, maximizing what you get from this bandwidth. We have the opposite situation. We have the thin pipe on the other side, and we have a fat pipe to the content management system. And it makes the wrong policy decisions. I'll get back to that one. You can also call it Akamai. I have no idea what an Akamai contract is these days. One of the problems about an Akamai contract is that it's a one-way street. Once you've started using Akamai, there's no way back. You just keep paying. I've not heard of anybody who's would migrate away from using Akamai again. That's because they deliver a good service, but it's also an expensive service. So Varnish is Anas's baby, and the name comes from the third meaning of the word varnish in the dictionary, to give a deceptively attractive appearance to something. And we're talking about making the content management system look good. So the cheat sheet is that Varnish is web acceleration for slow CMS systems. It has a very narrow focus on server-side speedup. There's no FTP, but it does offer content management features. This is sort of an overview first. We'll get all the details in a moment. It's high performance. It's built to run on 32 and 64-bit systems. It uses send file, accept filters. Any feature we can get our hand on that works, we'll use it. It's built to work on SMP and multi-core systems. In the future, we'll see chips with 8, 16, 32 cores on them. We need to be able to parallelize over those to exploit the hardware. It has a 2006 software design. And at this time, we're doing 11 system calls and 7 context switches to service a request. I have no idea how many Squid does. I've not measured. This is very, very fast. It's designed for performance. Do not move data unless you have to. There's no point in shifting data around if you can use it in the format you have. And also, don't do text processing on all the header lines. You only need to look at very few header lines. Forget about the rest. They're not relevant. We do things like we have a chunk encoding from the backends. When you run a CGI script on a web server, the web server will say, okay, here's 200 bytes, here's another 100 bytes, here's 10k bytes. Give you small chunks that way. And then in the end say, okay, that was all. We take all that, back it up in memory, so that we can send it to the client saying, here's 110,002 bytes, and send it off. That's much faster on the client side. We also cache that we cannot cache something. This is kind of interesting. When a request comes in, and we don't know anything about this, we go to the backend, to the content management system, and we get something back which, for some reason, we conclude we cannot cache. It may have a maximum lifetime of 0 seconds. It may have no cache, fragment. We decide we cannot cache it. So we make an entry in our hash that says, if this one comes back, we know we can't cache it. Go directly to the backend. The advantage to this is that we can make the decision up front that this will not be cached. We don't need to wait until we get the answer from the backend to say this one will not be cached. That gives a pipelining advantage to the speed. And we try to maximize the session usage, both for the backend and for the front end, to minimize the number of TCP connections and maximize the number of objects we send on them.
Question?
Yeah?
About this cannot be cached. Is there an assumption that this is static
No.
for some piece of content?
No.
This one? No.
I have a surprise. it's actually starting down here. We have something called ECL. We have a pass-through mode, which is what we do when we can't cache things. We know we can't cache them. And basically, we pass it on to the back end and get the response back. But we try to do it in a way that we can reuse both the TCP connections afterwards without closing them. When Squid has to go to the back end, the TCP connection closes. You have to open a new one for the next object. We're trying to reuse them. But we also have a pipe mode, because sometimes people access an HTTP server and switch to an entirely different protocol. It used to be that my home banking, you'd go in with a Java applet, it would open a connection to that server, and it would change to run SNA, right? And we need to be able to pass that kind of stuff through. So we have a pipe mode where we simply pass bytes between the backend and the client. We don't know what they mean. You select that in the VCL code. These are some numbers. Somewhere, digit two. These are some numbers from a test we did day before yesterday. Running at 100 megabits a second. Statistics for 1,000 cache hits is that we have an average time from we get the last byte of the request till we're ready to send the first byte of the answer of 71 microseconds. If we take the top 90% of them, the answer is 16 microseconds. In the meantime, it's dropped a couple of microseconds too. I think we're down to about 11 now. We keep finding things to tweak. That's because we basically do as little as at all possible to spend time in Varnish. We try to get the maximum bang out of the CPU without doing expensive operations. The graph at the bottom here is a smoke ping graph. Do you know smoke ping? Okay. Basically what you have here, you can see there's a green line. The green line is the median response time for HTTP requests against VG.NO. And the gray area sort of indicates what the spread in the range is. Now, if you look at this one, can you pinpoint the first 2 days where we did run a Varnish server on VG.NO? It is over here, right? Here we're running at what, 8, 10 squid servers?
10
squid
ten,
servers?
10 or 11, yeah.
Here we're running one Varnish server next to them. Over here we ran for several days. There's some spikes here, that's whatever we found a software bug in Varnish crash or something, or we played too much with the LTN load balance and stuff. But basically, Varnish is a heck of a lot faster. This is not throughput, this is response time. There's a big difference. We have to optimize for both parameters. But we've also made this a content provider thing. You can do things like invalidate a cached object instantly. And you can do it with a regular expression instantly. You can tell Varnish to throw out all JPEGs, and they will be gone like this, even if you have a million cached items. I think, as I've understood it, this is a feature you really like to have when the police is there with a court order about the thing you wrote on the front page. We also have expiry time control. You can modify, the backend will send you some HTTP headers, and they're written by somebody who's better at SQL than HTTP in all likelihood. So you can modify the policy in the VCL facility, and you can do load and situation mitigation in the VCL facility. And what is this VCL facility? Oh. It's a programming language. We made a programming language and we put it right in the middle of Varnish. You write a program. It gets compiled to C code. C code gets compiled to machine code. So it executes at full speed on a modern CPU. It's not scripting. It's not something like Perl that has to go out and interpret the bytecode and yada, yada, yada. It gets compiled to C code. The C code gets compiled to machine code and runs at full speed. We've not done anything yet in VCL we could see any impact on speed. So it's a small programming language for doing web caching. You can have multiple programs loaded at the same time and switch from one to another. That's instant. The request that's in the pipeline will continue using the VCL program they started using, but all new requests from that moment will take the new one. So you can switch from one to another like that. And this is a small mock-up VCL program. You can do things like say, if this is a local IP address, we'll just pass it. We don't want to cache the web developers because they'll just complain about the lag and the delay and so on. We can rewrite headers. If this one is CNN, we change it to vg.no because clearly somebody misspelled something. And you can get into really weird things like saying, if the backend is not up, but the object does exist, give it another 10 minutes lifetime and deliver it. And switch to the config that's called oh shit, which does whatever it does. You write that one. If you want to redirect to another data center, try another backend. The point here is, if you look at a configuration file of Squid, it has this many features. You can have access lists that control one thing and some access lists that control something else, and you're stuck with no idea in what sequence they're applied. When you look at a Squid config file, you have no idea what it does because it doesn't tell you the order and the dependencies between the things. We're trying to avoid that one by making it a sequential programming thing. You can go through the code and see what will happen. This is really interesting. You can do weird things. If you hate somebody, you can really make their life miserable this way. We're not even close to finishing the VCL language. We keep thinking up good features to add. One of the things you can do is you can examine... Yes?
Load balancing.
You can do really weird stuff. It's kind of like you're writing your own web cache here. So anything you can think of making a web cache do, provided we give you the keywords in VCL, you can do it. One of the things you can examine is the traffic level from the IP number the request came from. You can go in and say, if this request came from somebody who's using more than 20 megabits a second, sleep 100 milliseconds before replying. So when somebody misconfigures their Microsoft cache the entire web thing and comes in soaking up 50 megabytes, you can put a delay of 100 milliseconds in front of each of their requests to slow them down. Or you can just basically deny it if you don't like them or something. You can make the content people see depend on what IP number they come from, kind of the domestic local thing that New York Times tried to do recently, except they tried to do it by making their article an ad. Kind of weird thing. We also have try to make operation and maintenance easier. The cluster controller has not been implemented yet, but everything that's needed for it is there. Basically, the idea is you have a number of Varnish cache machines sitting, like one in each data center maybe, one in Denmark, one in Germany, whatever. And you have a cache control cluster machine. so that if you want to load a new VCL program, you only have to do it one place and it will load it on all of them, so that it will aggregate your statistics and stuff like that. That's one of the things we're hoping to do for version 2, but all communication with the Varnish server process is through a command line interface. You can telnet to it. Telnet localhost whatever port number you choose and give it commands that way. And obviously what the cluster controller is going to do is connect that way and talk to it through some kind of encryption, obviously. But it also means that the command line is very frugal with space, because one of the ambitions of Anders was to sit on his vacation in Bahamas and maintain his caches for his mobile phone with SMS messages. And we're within the 128 byte character restriction, so that shouldn't be a problem. Another place where Varnish is different is logging, because we don't write log files in Varnish. We have a shared memory segment. It's actually a mapped file, and we write the log data into that, because that means we don't have to wait for the disks when we do the logging. If we get a load spike, the logging will not hold us up. Logging, writing the log file is a surprisingly big load on Apache. Disabling log files makes your Apache go a lot faster. Varnish won't make a difference. What you then do is you have, yeah?
And just one question about that. We start using FIFO buffers for logging.
Yeah.
As a kind of workaround for that, exactly yeah. That problem. What kind of improvement can this provide?
The FIFO buffers still log in a textual format, which means that you have a very good chance that you need to parse the data to get at what you want. I'll get into the logging in more detail later, so let's take it up there. But
thanks.
But basically what you do here is, if you want logging in NCSA format, you run a program that tracks the shared memory and outputs NCSA records. If you want to monitor one specific instance of your server, you can do that with a program. One example of a program that we've written is Varnish Top. And basically you can tell Varnish Top to look at the RX URL records. That's receive URL from the client request. And you get, just like you get in top, what are people asking for? Which are the most used objects on the VG website? This is only a 2-second snapshot or something, so I don't think I'm revealing anything sensitive to Anders here. It's kind of interesting to see that the CSS is more interesting than the front page. I guess the CSS could use a higher lifetime or something. Here's another small program. It's called Varnish Hist, and it shows a histogram of the response time. So basically, this is how long time from last byte of request is received to we're ready to send the first byte of the answer. And this is 10 microseconds, 100 microseconds, 1 millisecond, 1 second over here. These are where we have to go to the back end. These are where we don't. And this is perfectly normal. It will flutter around down in the low microseconds. So in the end, this is kind of a boring program. it's probably better for looking after your back end than looking after Varnish at this point in time. But it's like 200 lines of code or something. And most of it is actually figuring out how to draw this in curses. Statistics, same story. We have it in the shared memory, which means that the program can monitor the statistics in real time. It's very important to understand that there's no system calls involved. You just map this file and you have a pointer to a 64-bit integer or whatever format the statistics item have, and just access it. You don't have to disturb the Varnish process by sending a request, tell me how many requests you've done or anything. It's accessed like that. So you can update your statistics 1,000 times a second if you want. It won't affect Varnish except for the load you put on the machine. So the short cheat sheet here is, I wanted to put this one in. VG has sponsored Varnish version 1.0 with 500,000 krona. And we have...
Actually, it's a bit higher than that.
Okay. That was the intent, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know how much we've gone over budget. There's 22,000 lines of code at this point in time. So that's around 22 krona per line. which I think is a fair price. As about, I think, we're actually approaching 1,100 check-ins now. So that's around 500 krona per check-in. It's kind of interesting to compare these numbers if you have followed systematic software development in ACM or anything like that. You know that people have been making statistics of this kind for years. Because if you're the Department of Defense and you're going to make a Star Wars Defense Initiative, and you're going to write a billion lines of code, how much money do we need to budget, right? And this is actually in the low end of the region, so I guess I've set my price too low for VGA. I should beat it up a little bit next time. I think it's a good deal. We have a web page. I think this is the right URL, right?
But I can fix it.
Okay, whatever. I can just, and we need to work more on that.
Yeah. That URL goes to the development page. It goes to track.
Okay.
It doesn't go to the... Yeah.
You heard our webmaster. I did most of the coding. It should run on any reasonable new modern Unix. Probably even AIX. There shouldn't be anything inherently impossible in getting it to run on any system that has a minimally functional pthreads implementation. What speed you'll get is an interesting question. But it needs the mmap system call and need pthreads, and that's basically it. Well, network stack, but everybody has that. And it's open source, multi license.
Yeah. But I suppose to have any sort of decent performance with many thousand clients, you should have an operating system that supports either Kernicuse or EPOL, right?
That's a good question. We don't know yet. I tried running with the Apollo-based acceptor, and it didn't really cost that much. So at this point, I would say I really don't know what kind of hardware you need for what kind of performance. I can see we have one data point right now that says that we can serve a hell of a lot with a dual processor option, but 12 years ago, we could satisfy a 100 megabit Ethernet with a 486 DX50. So we should be able to do at least gig E these days on a computer that's what, roughly 1,000 times faster, right? 100 times faster, I guess it would be. So performance-wise, we're pretty much in the dark yet. We haven't really characterized what the situation is. Those were sort of the marketing management summary slides. The other ones are less organized because I didn't get time to edit them now. If there's an OpenOffice expert in the audience, I have an interesting error message to show you. So this is the more technical side of it. And I was quite skeptical when I was first approached about this because it's not really something I do. I'm kind of a kernel guy, device driver, this kind of stuff. And it's not web servers, you know, it's kind of like, but on the other hand, I'm pretty tired of people writing NASA programs and blaming the kernel I've been working on for a decade. Oh, this sucks now, your program sucks, right? So this is a good chance to educate by example. This is how to use a modern operating system to get your performance served. If you look at RFC 2616, which is the controlling RFC for HTTP, it talks about caches on the client side. You can have a private cache, like in your Firefox, which it's okay to cache password-protected documents on. You can have a shared cache, where you shouldn't cache things that are password-protected and so on. But it doesn't say anything about caches over here. You can have a number of caches on the way, but they're all considered client-side caches. When you're client-side cache, you don't trust origin servers. They're the enemy. If you can get a bit more performance for your user at the expense of that poor web server, who cares? We'll open 1,000 TCP connections if we can. Anything it says is law. You're not allowed to do any interpretation. If you can make sense of it, follow the rules. If you can't make sense of it, hey, pass it through, see what happens. The cache is supposed to be semantically transparent at any cost. If in doubt, don't cache. And if the origin server does not reply, hey, Somebody has a problem. Our situation is different. We are on this side of the fence. We are seen from the users, we are the web server. We are the original server. But seen from the content management system here, we're a client. So we're sort of a dual role, which means you have to have this kind of split vision when you read the RFC. Kind of like use 3D glasses, one red, one green, to see which side of the fence you're on. And the situation is different. We're on the same side as the backend server. It's our friend. In fact, we're supposed to protect it. And we may actually have part of the content generation responsibility. We may have to fix up TTLs, insert headers, whatever, for the backend. We may be responsible for tracking the advertising click-throughs, registering the log files for that. Whatever happens, protect the backend. We cannot just say, okay, we don't understand this, ask the backend. Somebody writes a wrong URL on the front page, oh, we don't understand this, send it to the backend. That's a no-go. We must be able to go in and do something. And if the backend doesn't reply, we should do something. This is where it gets tricky. We need to have this one sort of in place before the rest of the talk, so I'll go through it quickly. We have one binary program that contains two processes. There's a management process, which is the one that comes up when you start the binary. The management process contains all the overhead stuff. Once you decide to start running, it forks itself. So you're executing the same binary, and you get a child process, which is the one that will do the real work. The reason why there's only one binary is that's very easy. A lot of people will start using Varnish at 3 o'clock in the night when somebody is hammering their web server because they got on the front page of Time or something. One binary, copy it over, give it the right parameters, and you're running. We want Varnish to have a very easy get started, get moving, get on with the real life. So copy one file and you go again. You don't have to copy all of user local blah and all the language files for Swahili just in case or something. One binary, you move it. So there's a command line facility here, which is the one you use to issue commands to it. If you want to load a different VCL file, if you want to, whatever you want to do, you go through the command line interface. There's actually a command line interface between the management process and the cache process, because it's easier to just reuse the code. From the outside, when we get the cluster controller, it will use the same facility. You'll issue something from your SMS telephone, come in that way. There's a VCL compiler. It takes your VCL program, compiles it to C code, runs it through the C compiler, makes a shared object, which gets loaded in to the cache process. So your code executes directly in the cache process. The cache process has a accept backend facility for handling TCP connections. It has a pool of worker threads that does the actual work. Once we have a complete request, one of the worker threads gets deal with this. So the VCL code is actually executed in the context of a thread, which means you can do things like sleeps in the VCL code. There's a cost of that, of course, but you can't do it. There's a Grim Reaper to remove stuff from the cache when it expires. We have the logs and statistics module, which writes to shared memory, from which other processes can pick it up. And we have the storage hashing facility for actually keeping track of all the objects we're caching. I'll be talking about various of these on along the way, and yell at me if you don't understand what I'm saying. We've seen that one already. So the VCL code. What happens is we get a request in, and the first thing we do is schedule a worker thread. The worker thread will call the VCL receive function. We haven't done anything, we call the VCL receive. The VCL receive function is a good place for doing things to the request before you commit to even doing anything about it. This is where you say that from this IP number we don't service it, or we delay it 100 milliseconds, or whatever you want to do. You can rewrite it entirely. You can say we don't take these requests turn them around, do something else. And you get to choose what to do next. You could do a lookup. You could send it to Pipe saying, I know this one. They're running SNA in the background. Go to Pipe. Or you can go to Pass saying, we know this cannot possibly be cached because it's advertising or whatever it is. You go to Pass mode where it's sent on to the backend. And that's all you have to do. If you do a lookup, you'll either hit or miss in the cache. You get a VCL function for either one. The hit function will typically say, OK, deliver. The cached object is delivered, and you're done. The miss function, you can actually, at this point in time, go to pass if you want to. I couldn't draw all the arrows. But you can go to pass mode at this point. You also go to type mode. You can even rewrite it and go back to lookup. That's not quite working yet, but the intent is you can. But normally what you do is you do a fetch, which picks it up from the back end. Once you have the headers, you get the VCL receive, which is where you decide, is this cacheable? By default, we use the TTL expiry algorithm from RFC 2616. If there's a cookie, if there's authentication headers, we do not cache it. Does it have a time to live that's greater than zero? Then we do cache it. So. But you can modify all that here. You can say, OK, it has a cookie. We don't care. We cache it anyway. You get to change all that stuff. Typically, you'll do an insert it into the cache, and deliver. Finally, we have the Grim Reaper. One of the problems about a cache is at some point your front page expires. If you don't react until it expires, you'll have a number of requests piling up while you pick it up from the backend. So the idea about the Grim Reaper is that it runs a number of seconds before things expire, like 30 seconds before it expires. And you call this VCL timeout to decide if they should be discarded or prefetched. At this point, you can examine how many times has this object been used. You can examine the date in the URL if you want. All that sort of stuff. So if it hasn't been used, why prefetch, right? Or if you know this one is going to be used nonetheless, you can always prefetch. And this is the current structure of the VCL facility. We can insert more of these methods. If we want a call that goes in, if the backend fails, we can add a VCL backend host or something. So this is the current model of it, and we're very interested in feedback on it. But let me try to explain some of the things that we've thought of so far. The VGE backend system issues purge requests. When they update a story, they want to purge it from the caches, even though it has a lifetime of maybe 2 hours. So they send an HTTP purge URL, purge URL HTTP 1.1 requesting. So we get that in up here. We treat it as a get at this point. So we go down to the lookup. If we get a hit, we take the object, set its remaining lifetime to zero, canceling it, and return a 200 code saying, we're done. We get a miss, we don't need to do anything. Of course, we don't fetch it because they want to purge it. That would be stupid. But we basically implemented a new HTTP request in VCL code, entirely in VCL code. Another example is the Google spider will come by every night and start to pick up your 3 years old archive of articles. In VCL miss, you could say, if the user agent has the word spider in it, we're not going to pick it up. We'll say, what is it, 305 content unavailable right now or something. You don't have to pick it up for them. You'll give them anything you have in the cache, but nothing else. Or you could examine the URL and say, okay, we'll give them anything in the last 10,000 relevant articles, but we'll not give them anything older than that. You get control at all steps here to go through and do what you want to do. If you have somebody who's misconfigured something and they're blasting 100 megabit of traffic at you, you can go in up here and say, if this IP number requests more than 20 megabits a second, delay 100 milliseconds between each request to slow them down. And the point is, you don't have to do this in advance. When you figure out you have a problem, you rewrite your VCL code, you load it, and you switch, and you're running on it. You don't have to stop your cache process for it. You don't have to lose your entire cache. You can do it on the fly. And if you don't get it right the first time, you just change it and try again until you get it right. there's a general target you can hit from everywhere that's called error. At any one point here, you can issue an error, HTTP error, and you can invent your own if you want. 721, I want to confuse your client. We're only scratching the surface of this yet. Some of the things we've talked about in the development process are really spaced out features. Like, if you want to do authentication, but you want maximum cache efficiency, what do you do? Right. Up here, you recognize requests as coming on a new session. So they get sent to the backend. Then you look at what the backend sends back. If what comes back from the backend is the password page, then they're not authenticated. If what comes back from the backend is different from the password page, then obviously they cleared it with the backend. And we can cache everything after that. So the first request on each TCP session, we send that to the backend. If the backend liked them, that's fine. Then we can cache the rest of that TCP connection. That way we can take an authenticated user load off the backend, apart from the very first one they send on each request. You can do that in VCL. So there's some really weird things to be done. At some point, we'll probably implement facilities for cookie dismantling so that all the cookie handling can be offloaded up here. It's basically a matter of somebody needing it bad enough to either pay us to do it or doing it themselves and sending us the patches. So there's a open party here for anybody who likes to play with stuff. This is the same slide we had in the other talk. So performance programming. Performance programming is actually very easy, although people tend to get it wrong. The first rule is use few cheap operations. Second rule is use even fewer expensive operations. And the one I want to stress tonight is do not fight your operating system kernel. It's a really stupid thing to do because it can do really nasty things to you. You're not going to win over the kernel. So use the nice features the kernel guys have given you. Just people like me, right? Here's a price list. Basic arithmetic is free. There's no cost. Your CPU does things, who cares? Examining data starts to get expensive. It's stupid to call string length if you already know the length. It may be cheaper to cache the length in a variable than to actually pick it out again. Copying things around is even more expensive because now you start talking about taking one set of memory locations and sticking them in another one. Locking. Now things start to get bad. When you have multiple threads and you start locking them against each other, you may have to stop and start some of them if the log is not available. You want to have your lock contention minimal. System calls are bad. System calls on a modern CPU will take thousands of CPU cycles, tens of thousands of CPU cycles, just for the system call. Not for the work the system call is doing, but we're talking get PID here. It needs to save the entire context. It needs to change the page tables. It just, if you look in the CPU manuals, you see this instruction that's like, update the page table header, and it's like 1072 plus clock cycles. We're not talking RISC CPUs here anymore. So system calls is a really bad idea. Something as relatively innocent as figuring out the time of day is actually surprisingly expensive. Because for some reason, CPUs hardware has lousy hardware support for finding out what time of day it is. It would probably cost them an entire dollar to make it better, and you know, margins are tight. Context switches are even worse than system calls. But not for the reason you think. The reason why context switches are bad is you change memory layout. If nothing else, just changing from one thread to another thread in the same application, you change the stack segment. And most of the activity in C code, C++ code, happens from the stack. Which means everything you have in your cache, too bad. Modern CPUs have caches in the megabyte sizes. If you're running Itanium, anybody here running Itanic? Why?
2,000 Unix boxes, we have everything.
Oh, one of those. Well, you may have a chip with a 9 megabyte cache on it. And that's sort of insane. We used to run the world's largest FTP server on that sort of memory. I've been thinking about it, actually. I've been thinking about it for embedded application. It could be fun to take a modern CPU and run Unix entirely in the cache. You can do that. Many of the access points that run a Linux kernel and stuff like that have 2 megabytes of memory. This one has, I think, what, 4 megabytes of cache. You can run out of the cache. Now we're talking. You have a memory failure. I don't care. Context switches are bad. Avoid them if you can. But it's still a lot better than disk access. Disk access, these are sort of a gradual scale. This is like jumping the Colorado River. Disk access means moving things, physical things, from one place to another using magnetic fields and what lineup. We're talking about moving from the microsecond range to the millisecond range, with a factor of 1,000 and more here. You really don't want to touch the disk if you can avoid it. And even worse, if you want to touch the disk, you do not want to get the file system involved, because the file system says, oh, I have a directory somewhere over there, and there's an inode over there, and it says the file is spread all over the place. You'll never get anything done if you use the file system. I don't know, I'm looking forward to getting a flash disk in my laptop. First of all, the noise, but second, the speed. All the file systems will have to be redesigned when we get moved to flash media. There's no seek time. All the file systems spend a lot of time figuring out, oh, the head is here and I can move there. That's the shortest one. Forget about it. Flash disk has no seek time. I'm so looking forward to what Hans Eiser is going to say about that. It's like, I spent my lifetime optimizing seek time. What do you mean there's no seek time? I'm really looking forward to that one. Traditional locking is horribly expensive. This is the archetypical thing. You open a log file, you do that once, forget about that. Then you say, okay, fprintf, flog, blah, 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 blah. That's cheap, right? First, fprintf will format your string into a memory buffer. If you're lucky, it will format it directly into the output buffer. If you're unlucky, it will format it into a temporary buffer and then move it into the output block. Now we're already up to the three levels up the price list, right? Next thing it will do will issue a system call, right? Once they're up, what will the system call do? It will say, oh, I need to do disk IO, right? Using the file system. You go all the way through the price list. It's like going into a French high cuisine restaurant saying, I'll take one of each. You can't afford that. And it does you no good in the end. This is how you do locking. You memory map your file. You have a point to the start and the end. You put in your lock record. Memory assignment. You have to format your thing. You do it directly into your buffer. At the end, you said, okay, there's a log entry here. At past the end, you said one thing, it stops here, and then you said one thing, that's the end. And you're done. No system calls. No context switches. Bit of memory copy. But it can be done better. Because we can keep track of both ends of the string, so that we don't have to run string length on it to figure out how long it is. So, you can use memcpy. If you look at the source code for memcpy, it's actually assembler code. It will start out saying, okay, how many bits are left if I copy this one as 64 32-bit units? Okay, that's 3 bytes. Move 3 bytes, then moves 32 bits at a time. If you look at string copy instead, it will move 1 byte at a time because it has to stop when it gets to a 0. memcpy is likely to be 4 to 10 times faster than string copy. Hey, it's not much, you don't use it very much, but we're talking high performance here. We have two shared memory locking functions in Varnish. One that takes a range, start pointer, end pointer. I will just memcpy that directly into the lock. HTTP headers, I know where they start, I know where they stop. Stick this in the bubble. If I have to give print out a message saying, okay, this took this blah 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 number of seconds, we have a printf format thing. The first thing this one will do is check if there's any percent signs in the string in the first place, and if there's not, we'll call this one with it instead. There's no need to run through printf if there's no percent sign in the format string. But we're not done yet. Our worker threads has a shared memory buffer. And we lock into that one. Because we're the only user in this thread. We don't need to do any locking. We just stay appended to the buffer. It's just memory copy into this buffer. And once we're done with this HTTP request, we'll go down, take a lock, append it to the global lock, to the shared memory lock, and release the lock. So in essence, we have around one memory or one pthreads mutex operation per request for locking. Compare that to fprintf. I know what's faster. There's practically no mutex contention. I think we're seeing about 70 contested mutexes a second, running 5,000 HTTP requests a second. Who cares? But there's more to it. Your call dumps contain your log file, the most recent bit of it. So if you send me a call dump for your Varnish process, I should be able to see the tail of your log entries, see what it was actually doing. In each thread, I can see what it was doing most recently. And we can afford to log much more detail. If you look at the output of Apache's log files and so on, there's a lot of things they won't tell you because it would take up space in the log file. You'd run out of disk space. We can't afford that I/O band. We can. We log approximately 30 log entries per request. Each of the received and transmitted headers get logged in its own log request because it's a lot easier for the log parsing programs. You get the raw data to play with. We log timing information, how long time did it take us to compose the answer, how long time to transmit the answer, what was the inter-request interval on the TCP connection. We can afford to log all this stuff because it's free to log it, which means we can do data mining on our logs and figure out things, how to optimize Varnish, see web patterns. Right now we're logging around 30 records per request, and that easily runs into 100,000 records a second. But it's in a shared memory buffer, it just overwrites. If you want it written to a file, you can do that. That would cost you the CPU time. But if you just want to pick up some of the bits, do that and forget about the rest. I showed the Varnish top before. Here's another way to use the Varnish top program. Why do TCP connections close? We have a message that's called session close to tell us that. And we can see most of them are timeouts, which means we have a 5-second timeout. If they don't say anything, we'll close it. We're not going to hold the TCP connection open forever if they don't have any. About 25% of them, the other end closes, decides they do not need to talk to us. Somebody clicked on some link and went somewhere else, and the browser says, oh, I won't need this. We have about 5%. Which are not HTTP 1.1. A lot of these are people writing scripts to print a little icon with the weather or something. Some of the people who do that can even figure out what the HTTP protocol is. There's one of them that comes in with get something, and then what is it? HTTP underscore default version. I'm like, yeah, buddy, you try that. People ask deliberately to get it close. Remote closed is different from UF in when it happens. This one happens while we're answering them. This one happens while we're waiting for to get a request from them. Silent means they opened a TCP connection and never used it. I'm a bit worried about those. But they may simply be browsers, kind of. Opera is a very aggressive browser. Any Opera developers here?
Used to be.
Okay. Opera is a very aggressive browser. And as far as I can tell, when you go into a website, they'll open a number of TCP connections, expecting to need them. And maybe they won't, so they'll close them again. That's close to antisocial behavior. with a pipe request, we don't know what the protocol what protocol has been running, so we can't reuse it, so we have to close it. These two are actually the purge facility we did for VG. So we can see that most of what they purged are actually not even in the cache in the first place. No request is where we serviced one request and I can't remember. And we have a few bad requests where people send things that simply doesn't make sense. But you can go in and examine all the different log records we have. You want to see the most used user agent? We can do that. And the VarnishTalk program is like 200 lines. There's, if you ever program PCAP programs, it's basically sort of the same thing. You say, okay, open the shared memory log, call this function for each record. And you can say, I only want to see client records. Yeah, I only want to see the records that pertain to client-side communications or backend-side communications, stuff like that. And there's a default set of options you can give. Capital I means include, and capital X means exclude, and you give it the regular expressions. So if I could say here, session close is a bad example, but if I gave RH URL, I would say minus capital I JPEG. So received URLs, with JPEG in them, show me which one is the top image or whatever. It's sort of like inspired by TCP dump in some ways, and we should probably think about the kind of very flexible syntax TCP dump has at some point. It would be a very interesting program project if we have somebody who needs to write a small programming language or command, what is it, expression parsing thing for a assignment somewhere. Of course, the idea is not to spend too much time on your logging, but analyzing it might be a good idea. Statistics, we talked about that one already. And why do people program like it's 1970? Modern textbooks will still write drivel like this. Any of you seen a computer like this anywhere outside a museum recently?
Yeah, I've been lying around somewhere.
You're running NetBSD. This is more like it. This is the kind of crap architecture we have to deal with. We're lucky. This kind of shit came to mainframes 25 years ago. If you want to see what's in store for the personal computer, read the history of the IBM mainframe. They started out with a computer, with a CPU and memory and a disk. Then they needed to optimize performance, so they did this and they did that. If you look at what they managed to squeeze in to the central processing units of the ESA series, it's like they have instructions for executing KIX transactions. You really don't want to know. They have instructions for handling SNA communications. Because if they attempt to make 1,000 chips, perfectly happy if only 10 of them come out good, because they're getting megabucks from these chips. And if they can run 1% faster, somebody's willing to pay for it. State of the art in what you can squeeze into a CPU, that's IBM mainframes. You'd be impressed. It's really, one of their designers wrote a book about it. And when you read it, you kind of have this nagging idea that this is actually Mr. Bean trying to explain something. He cannot possibly be serious. They were not allowed to export hardware that could do desktop encryption. But they wanted to speed up encryption. So they implemented a general instruction for doing S-boxes. It's just logical operations. There's nothing to do with encryption, nothing whatsoever, right? But it meant you could write a desencryption in 8 instructions.
Coming up next.
After this commercial break. In a modern mainframe, they have a gadget called Prism. They switched to serial front-side buses a long time ago. Some of them are even optical now. They have a gadget called a Prism, where you can move CPUs and memory around and configure your system in virtual machines, and kind of like, I want 1.7 CPU in this one. Right? It's really long-haired hardware design. If you look at that, you know where the PC is going to end up, because they're going to fight for performance, and clock speed didn't make it. We hit the 4 gigahertz barrier, and now we're going to go multi-core. And around 16 cores, they're going to figure out the programmers can't figure out how to use that many cores, so they'll have to figure something else. And if you thought the i386 instruction set was complicated now, wait 10 years. You'll have really weird instructions like pass HTTP header and do something sensible with it. You can't program against this. It's impossible. There's no way you can program for this kind of stuff. In the operating system kernel, we have to deal with it. But you cannot micro-optimize for this. You don't have to. If you understand this conceptual model, you'll do very fine. You have a number of CPUs, or cores as they're called these days. Each of them have a private cache. That's important to remember. You have a very big cache. People insist on calling it RAM. I don't know why, but it's a cache. What it caches is chunks of objects on your disks, or other storage, or across the network. But it's very important to understand, this is not called RAM, it's called cache. Because the operating systems, ever since virtual memory came around, has tried to make this a cache. That's the entire point about virtual memory is, you don't need to know how big this one. You just take what you want. And if there's physical memory, it will run faster. If there's not, your IBM salesman will be around. sorry. Time lapse that. This is what people have not figured out. They've only had 20 years. I admit this is a bit on the early side yet, but this is going to be a big thing once people figure it out. This is where performance comes from. Squid is this 1970s. It has some objects are in memory and some are on disk. And it does explicit transfer between. Move in, move out. Yeah. Let's look at how that looks. Squid creates a memory object because it picks up something from the backend. It gets used, and it falls into disuse. The kernel needs more RAM for the cache, so it pages it out. It's not being used. Then Squid decides it's not being used, and it should be moved to disk. So it creates a file, open yada yada directory yada yada disk, blah, 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 and it has a file. And it says, write. Only the memory is not there. The kernel takes the page form, goes to the disk, yada, blah, blah, reads it into memory, so that Squid can say, okay, now write it to a file. Now Squid can use the object for something else. A little later, it needs that one anyway. So now it needs to free up some memory. So it has to take one of the memory objects and write to disk, repeat all of the above, and then it can read that one back in again so that it can send it to the client. At this point, the poor kernel is shaking his head and doing the best it can, but it's absolutely trashing moving things out of the disk and wondering what the fuck this Squid thing is doing. This is what happens when you don't read modern computer textbooks. The way Varnish does it is, it creates the object in virtual memory. We use this cache thing. What we really created in, we open one file. It may be some number of hundred of gigabytes, we don't really care. And we take a chunk of that for our object. There's no need to have a file for each individual object. We just need to know it's from here to there. We use it, we stop using it. If the kernel wants to reclaim that bit of the cache, it reclaims that bit of the cache. We don't care. If we need it again, we'll just take it from there and send it to the client. And the kernel will page it in for us. All that memory management, is this one busy? Should this one be moved in? It's in the kernel already. Why should I code it up again? There is a bit of a problem, and that is on 32-bit systems, you're limited to 2 gigabytes of virtual memory. That's because 32 bits give 4 gigabytes of addressable. You simply cannot have a machine code with an address that's larger than 4 gigabytes on a 32-bit system. There's something called PAE, which is...
physical address extension.
Physical address extension, yes, which means the kernel can see more memory, but you can still only, in your program, see 4 gigabytes. Unfortunately, the kernel reserves, the PCI bus reserves about half a gig of it, and the kernel needs also typically about half a gig or 1.5 gig. So you have about 2 gigabytes left. But I don't see that as a problem in 2006. If you have a web server with 2 gigabytes of content, you can afford to buy a CPU that can run 64-bit mode. We're talking, what, $1,000? Including motherboard, $1,200? So, yes, we're kind of handicapped with 32-bit machines. We run fine on 32-bit machines, but you have a space limitation. It's not an issue going forward. Obviously, it's not a fault of Squid to be written in the time it was written. Squid was written for VAX computers originally. The fault is it hasn't been updated. And one of the reasons why it hasn't been updated is that the overall architecture of the thing needs updating. You need to take Squid and say, okay, bye, and start over again. If the Squid people want to take Varnish and implement the Squid features on top of it, they're more than welcome. You can do a client cache here. A client cache is mostly about nitpicking HTTP headers. We try to get away from as much of that as possible because our task is speed and simplicity, because we only have one backend server, we don't have to control most of the domains. But if somebody wants to have a client-side cache, take Varnish, move from there, you get all the storage architecture. And about text processing. Text processing is bad because people tend to spend way too much time at it. Hemingway generally spent 4 times as much editing his text as writing it, which is probably why it's so good, by the way. Don't spend time text processing things. People who program in C++ have a tendency to copy strings from here to there, from there to here, all over the place. That's the point of it. Our task is to receive an HTTP header. We do that. Then we split it into different fields and whatnot. We don't need to copy it. We have a lump of memory. We have one string starting here and there, one there, and so on. There's no need to copy them out into individual strings. Most of them, I won't even examine them. I don't care what's in the user agent header, unless an ETL program tells me to. Why should I parse it and split it into fields and find semicolons? Keep track, start and stop. Insert null characters if you want to use functions that don't understand the other format, and off you go. A lot of time is wasted here. It used to be that you had to conserve memory and so on. Each worker thread has a workspace, and we just use that. 8K memory is nothing these days. It's 1,000 of your CPU cache. So how to find a given HTTP header? I have to examine some of the headers in the source code, like the connection header. I have to look at that. I encode the length in front of the string. This code is actually wrong. I did the wrong cut and paste, I realized. So this is one of the slides that should have been updated. But basically, the trick is to say, if the string I'm examining is shorter than what I'm looking for, don't bother. There's no need to run a string compare if I know the string is not long enough to be satisfied. And I look for the colon being in the right place, because most of the headers have different length. So I can just go and say, is there a colon there? If there's not a colon there, it can't be this one. And then I run the string compare in that case. Memory management is another thing. C++ is totally hopeless at this point. You call new, you call destroy, or delete, new delete, new delete, new delete, and you trash your memory manager. I know this because I wrote one. Fortunately, I'm no longer the malloc maintainer previously now. We give each worker thread a workspace. And then when we build the response header to send to the client, we just take from this workspace. And once we've sent the request, we reset the pointer. We just use the same buffer over for each request the worker thread does. The advantage of this is, this piece of memory stays in the cache. It gets used a lot. If I called malloc and free, I would probably get some other piece of memory because it had a lower address or something completely irrelevant. And suddenly it would be in a different cache address. Use the same one. And I can free all of them with one operation because I know all of them are invalid when the request is done. When I've sent a reply, all the header edits and all that stuff that was done, forget about it. I'm done. The other thing is to pre-allocate objects before holding logs. When we go in to do a lookup of an object, if we don't find it, we know we're going to want to create it. So each worker thread has a hook, a pointer, for a new object. And before I do a lookup, I make sure there is an object sitting there, a blank, empty thread, ready to go object. So I take the log, I go through the hash table, I come down, I find there's nothing there. I put in that one and release the log. That way, I do not have to call malloc while holding the log, which means the window for contention on that log is much smaller. That helps keep log contention down. And remember all those caches in the picture. You want to reuse resources in last in, first out option, not in first in, first out. If you have 200 threads, the one you want to use next is the one that just finished doing something, because that's the one that has stack in cache, has its buffers in cache, and very likely, if you're lucky, on the same CPU you're running. Unfortunately, all the pthreads implementation I've seen so far, you have condition variables, and they do round robin. If you do a pool of threads with a condition variable in pthreads, you will take the one that has the highest chance of not being resident in any cache. Every time, all the time. You want to put, as soon as a thread gets free, you want to put it at the front of the queue, not at the back of the queue. These are elementary things. These are things we've been thinking about in the operating system kernel for 10 years. We've had to deal with kernel, with caches, and all that sort of stuff for 10 years. We need to get this kind of knowledge pushed out into the user land application area. That's the last slide I've prepared. Is there anything I should... No, I think that's it. We'll take it as questions and answers from here, I think. If there are any questions. Yeah.
Okay, you said that you could afford to log a lot of things, like lots of stuff about how long different things took, etc.
Yeah.
But you also said earlier that doing time operations was actually quite expensive.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Do as few time operations as possible.
Okay.
I didn't manage to get this one turned into a slide. That's not horribly readable, is it? Mm-hmm. Let me change screen resolution here. This is what I like about open source operating systems. It's so user friendly. That's more like it. Is that readable for you?
Yep.
This is basically my cheat sheet to what's going on in Varnish during the lifetime of a request. The first thing at the top is that we accept the TCP connection. that happens. We have a dedicated thread that does nothing but accept requests, set up a session structure, and pass it to a worker thread. So obviously we have the accept system call of that. We can't get around that one. It would have been smart if there wasn't accept that returned a range of file descriptors. Say, accept up to 10 and give me those. But I guess it hasn't been a performance problem yet. Eventually we will get one, I think. We have to allocate a new session. So that costs us a lock and an unlock. I'm using a trick there, I can show that on the blackboard afterwards. So actually, the slash in front of the lock, unlock, and malloc means it won't happen always. It only happens some fraction of the time. And I do a clock get time to find the time we opened the TCP connection. I need this for accounting and idle time. Then I queue it. I need to queue it on a thread, a worker thread. That will cost me a lock and an unlock. And there's nothing I can really do about that. I can make sure there's as little contention on that as possible. And I do a write. The worker thread, when it's idle, each worker thread has a pipe. When it's idle, it will read from this pipe. And the way I started from here is by writing to the pipe. That sounds backwards, doesn't it? Why doesn't the pthread condition variable work here? Well, the pthread condition variable was designed by computer scientists. And they don't know very much about how actual multiprogramming works. I would have to do what would amount to about 3 system calls to use the pthread facility. And give me a guarantee I don't need. All I need is some way from one thread to poke another one and say, get moving. Condition variables require me to hold a mutex. I don't need a mutex. I know the thread is stuck. I don't need the mutex. It's sort of like, but pipes are cheap. They cost some amount of memory for buffers in the kernel. And you do a system call on either side. And what's probably most important is that they're asynchronous, which means that it can schedule the other thread later on, because it doesn't have to kick it right now. But initially I use condition variables, and what will happen is the acceptor thread would say, okay, now poke this thread, and we'll schedule that thread, try to get the mutex that I'm still holding, and say, okay, I couldn't do that. Unschedule that thread, schedule this one again, I'll release the log, and then that one will schedule. It's like... So we use a pipe to start the worker thread. I may have to create a thread. The worker thread pool is dynamic. It will shrink and grow. So in some fraction of the cases, I may have to create a thread, but normally not. So that bit of it cost us 3 system calls, 1 log operation. The worker thread here will do a read. If we have the accept filters facility in FreeBSD, we'll only do 1 read by guarantee. In all likelihood, though, we'll only do 1 read anyway, because most browsers manage to get the entire HTTP request into one packet. Now, it's an interesting thing. If you use a BlackBerry or other mobile device, it will send you HTTP headers larger than anything you can imagine. I have no idea why they send headers this long. They probably contain some vital, important marketing information or something. But it seems counterintuitive to me that requests are larger from mobile devices than they are from...
It's mostly accept headers. They tell us what they want to accept.
Yeah, and they give you a URL to something about the kind of model they have and the software version they have in case you want to hack them. I don't know. I mean, I was surprised to see that the only request we got that was larger than 4K was from BlackBerry. Spell it out for somebody. I don't know. Anyway, we do a read to get the request, and most of the cases we'll only do 1 read. We do accounting on TCP. We keep track of source IP numbers and the traffic they generate. This can be disabled if you don't want the overhead. So we have to get the socket address stuff. Actually, the accept call already gives you the address directly. There's no need to go down and pick it up again. So that takes a get name info call to format it. We could do the formatting ourselves, basically it's printf, blah, blah, blah. But I've chosen to use the get name info because I don't want to get into the entire IPv6 thing. Git name info does that for me. I can just say, oh, but the library's off. Then we have to do a number of set socket options. And I've actually managed to get this one changed, because we have to set the linger option and receive and send timeouts. But this is stupid. These kernel guys are stupid. Why would I have to set this every time I accept a connection? I should set that on my accept socket, and it should inherit it. FreeBSD current does this now, after a slightly more polite email to one of the network people. That saves 3 system calls. This is worth money. This is like money in the bank. We're talking about dropping what, from 7 to 5 system calls for a TCP request, or HTTP request. That's worth taking. They're cheap ones though, but they save. We have to reference the source address structure. This, as I said, can be disabled. It will cost you a log operation, and that's not what you can do about it. So, score 1 in this column. We may have to receive some more if we didn't get all of it, but usually we don't. Actually, this is the same read as this one up here. They should be counted together. At this point, we've received the header. And here we do another timestamp. This is the time of the last header byte received, the one we calculate most of the performance from. We go to the lookup, we have go to the hash lookup. It may have to do a couple of mallocs if it risk inserts. This happens to about, in VG's case, less than 0.5% of the requests, so forget about those. Lookup takes a sequence of 3 locking operations. This may seem kind of stupid. I could do it in 1, surely. But if I do it in 1, I get 1 lock that's heavily contested. Doing it this way actually allows me to get 3 locks that are not contested, which means the program will run straight through, not need to do anything about synchronizing over the other threads. The level of contention on these locks is very, very low. The other thing is that say you start Varnish from scratch. The first request comes in from the front page. And 10 microseconds later, the next request from the front page comes in. The first one is already busy talking to the backend to pick up the front page. And when we get the reply from that, in all likelihood, we can cache it and give it to all of the ones waiting. So the object is marked busy while the backend is being contacted. And in order to be able to hold the object busy with this one and disembark the thread, because I don't want to hold a worker thread busy on this, because I can have a pileup of 200 requests for this one page. I don't want to tie up 200 worker threads for this. So I have to be able to disembark this request and come back later and jump into the middle of the processing here and say, now continue. And that complicates the locking a little bit here. There's also another thing, and that is, when you request slash on a web page, what you get may depend on the headers you send. CNN, for instance, will send you a compressed HTML. They will use transfer encoding, gzip, if they think you can get away with it. And there's a HTTP header called vary, which says the content depends on these headers. If they send these headers, then you can cache it. If they send different headers, you can't cache it. So for each lookup in the hash table, you have to have a list of objects that satisfy this URL, this host, but they may have different vary headers, they may have different expiry times, and so on. So there's a song and dance here, but overall, it will cost us 3 operations. And we get to deliver the result. We take a timestamp here again. That's a timestamp. Now we're ready to do the answer. And either we deliver with the right vector, that's actually a spelling error, or with send file. So far, I haven't seen any benefit from using send file. I think that's because we do not access the disk. We can state the entire VG content in memory on the 4 GB machine. Once you start having a larger content set where you need to move things to and from disk, I expect send file to start helping. But at this point, I haven't seen any effect from it, except I can change which system call is used. I have to dereference the hashed object. That will cost me another log operation. And I take a timestamp at the end also. I have to charge the statistics to the session. That will cost me another log operation also. and then I have to return the session to the acceptor. If the TCP connection is still open, then may come another request. I do the same trick. I write the session to a pipe, and the acceptor process will actually, that's down here. It's standing there. It's actually a different thread. It's standing with the KQ or POL or EPOL or whatever, listening to all these TCP connections and this pipe. So some fraction of the KQ call will be mine. It will come up with 100 events or whatever. And eventually we'll do a read, a lock, and an unlock to get it onto a different thread, to the right, and off the thread it goes again. So this is simply the bare minimum of expensive operations. You'll notice there's not a single file system operation here. If there is any disk activity, it's through the VM system doing all the caching. We kept us on the bottom half of the price list. And that is why violence is blindingly fast. We did 700 megabits and 10,000 requests a second. I think 500 megabits were Apache Bench, and about half the requests were Apache Bench. On a dual Opteron machine, and it was still like 40% idle. Not even close to breaking into a sweat. We haven't even started tuning the network stack. The only tuning we've done, this is FreeBSD 6.2 pre-release or whatever it's called right now. The only tuning we've done is increase all the limits, like how many file descriptors can you have, how many sockets can you have, all that sort of stuff, because we ran into all of those limits. They're kind of conservative on FreeBSD. There's no tuning apart from that. It's a generic kernel. Nothing magic. And I can't see why we shouldn't be able to fill a gigabit Ethernet. And I can't see why we shouldn't be able to fill more than a gigabit Ethernet, because, as I said, 10 years ago, we could fill 100 megabit Ethernet. Computers are a heck of a lot faster now. If you want to say, okay, I don't care about the statistics, you can pick up this one, and not that one, because we need that one for the timeout. If you have a working receive timeout option, you can do without that one. So we can basically at some point come down to something that says read requests, do a couple of locks, write answer for caching. Of course, if your cache hit rate is 1%, that's not going to help you much. The assumption here is that the caching is going to happen. Our number, I think number two user has a cache hit rate of, I think, 40%. It's some kind of discussion board thing. So they have very short lifetimes, but still they're getting a 40% cache hit rate, which is, he's happy about it, that kind of hit rate.
It's actually the company that hosts WordPress.
Oh, I thought I'd seen that name somewhere.
So they host WordPress.org, which is the community site, and WordPress.com, where all the blogs actually are.
And I believe we have the people behind user-friendly ready to test also pretty soon.
Oftenblabber.
Have also. And Fyn Stiftelsen in Denmark runs a lot of newspaper stuff, and they'll probably start testing. They had a deadline they had to get over, but they want to start looking at it now. So there's still a chance to be one of the single-digit users of Varnish.
I have a curl written, or written, whatever you want to say, website that might benefit from this. Have you heard about Catalyst? It says sort of different. It's not really a CMS, it's more like a site building thing, like Ruby and Rails, whatever.
I have to say that I am horribly ignorant about that entire side of things. My own homepage has an update rate of once every 5 years. It's due in 2008, I think. And my relationship with all this HTML kind of thing is entirely, I use a browser. And I read the RFC 2616. So, well, I can understand that. When you have to issue an RFC to clarify what you meant, and then have to issue a private draft to explain what the clarification meant, and then still have an email debate with people about what it meant, I think you should have done more editing. Maybe not. there's a lot of compatibility issues in that. So no, I must say I'm totally blind. But my point here is that no matter what you're using, whatever flaws it has, you should be able to remedy that in the VCL code. That's sort of the driving idea in the VCL code, is that whatever you need to do, you should be able to do it there, no matter what kind of handicap you've had from your content management system.
Given that this is a release party, does it mean you actually have a distribution already?
This is Doug Elling's point. I think the official tarball will be wrote tomorrow.
Yes. Okay. So. This is we should have called this a pre-release party. We're having a press conference tomorrow, and the tarball will be rolled tomorrow. The code is frozen. The documentation is frozen.
By frozen, we mean I do not have a network connection right yet.
Examples? Is basically my question.
All I'm going to do is do a white space cleanup of the source code and then branch and roll the tarball tomorrow morning and put it out on SourceForge. But what I was going to say is that the only kind of website that Varnish can't help you with is the kind of website where you have to generate, where the content that you generate really changes from request to request. For instance, Varnish couldn't accelerate google.com. Doesn't make.
Well, we could cast that logo. We could cast that logo.
You'd have a hit rate of 0.1% or something.
I've actually been told there's a surprisingly large number of people who go into Google front page every morning to see what the logo looks like. They don't search for anything.
What about those people searching for the same thing?
They don't even try to optimize for that, as far as I'm told. It would be more expensive to coordinate.
Jeg vil bare si at alle er hjertelig velkommen til VG i morgen klokka 2. Da er det en release, rett og slett, altså en pressekonferanse for Varnish. Med litt press og litt forskjellige ting. Da vil vi også snakke litt mer om Limpro sin rolle i det hele også. Det produktet vil være supportert fra Limpro. Slik at man kan rett og slett kjøpe støtte hvis man ikke har lyst til å leke med den grannen der selv. Og litt fremtiden, altså hva vi tenker for nå. Det var hvordan prosjektet går fremover fra nå. Så dette er egentlig, altså ordet Varnish kommer fra det samme ordet som ble brukt til det med vernissage. Sånn der forhåndsvisning. Så dette er egentlig en vernissage av Varnish.
This is what happens when people get a hurt their back and lie in their bed with a dictionary as the only reading.
Are you talking about situations where you have a lot of kind of web service calls, as in Ajax websites, stuff like that? Isn't that typically, wouldn't that be a very good program for a lot of VCL coding? The web 2.0 kind of thing?
Have you ever heard about the second system syndrome? No, it's actually seriously. There's a book called The Mythical Man-Month. It's written 35 years ago.
Frederick
P. Brooks. Nice old man. And he identifies something he calls the second system syndrome, which is why so many upgrades fail. And whenever people say web 2.0 kind of thing, I see this friendly face, Frederick P. Brooks, with a big white grin, going, yeah, I know how that will end. But, I mean, I really don't care what the content is. If it can be cached, I can cache it. If it can't be cached, I can't. It's totally transparent at this point in time. One of the things that the newspaper people are sort of really hoping to get in version 2 is edit, where you say, okay, I have this magic tag in the middle of it, and you take this other object and insert it there, server-side implements essentially. Have that happen at this level instead of happen at the content management side. And allowances have been made in the source design to make that happen. But we deemed it out of scope for version 1.0, and considering what we've been doing the last couple of days, I would say that was a good choice. But it's one of the high priority items for version 2.0 to be able to do that sort of thing. Whether that should be extended into a general object manipulation facility is an interesting question. At some point, you want to draw a line between the web server and the cache somewhere. And it's okay for it to be a slightly fuzzy line, but I do not want this to turn into a web server. So I think that in general, object modification, content modification, is probably not what you want to do in Monish. But the server side includes is a special case where what you do is composition. You assemble a number of objects to one object. And that's probably the most complex level of object editing that we'll do in Monish. Unless somebody comes up with a really good idea. One of the reasons for this is that doing server-side includes is practically free. What you do is you have one object and it turns into three objects. The first half of this object, some other object, and the second half of this object. It doesn't change the basic model where Varnish doesn't really inspect the content. It will have to inspect to find the tag. And it will probably be that you go into your VCL code and you say if the URL matches something, inspect for server-side includes. So that by default, you won't spend time going through the HTML to see if there's anything you should do. So the performance penalty will only hit when you ask for it, because there will be a performance penalty. One of the things about, I don't know if I made this clear enough with Varnish, is that if we use send file to transmit the content is not actually copied into the process. It will remain entirely in the kernel's address space after the initial read to the object. After that, the user's land will never see the actual content. It will just say, OK, from this address to this address, there's something sent over there. And we avoid that entire user space thing. In theory, it could actually be unmapped, but the sense file system call doesn't support that right now. Once you have to do content inspection, you have to go through that entire object. If the front page is 120 kilobytes, that means you're flushing out a large fraction of your cache just to find out if there's a tag you should substitute. That's going to slow things down a lot. A cache hit will if you run your CPU without the level 1 and level 2 caches these days, you'll feel like so Commodore 64-like that you won't believe it, because the pipeline delay is incredible. Modern CPUs only survive because of the caches. And therefore, content inspection is expensive. That's why you have web servers with fat CPUs to do that sort of stuff. So it's OK for the line to be sort of blurred, but I don't think you should expect too much in that area from Varnish.
Now we're seeing a lot of potential.
We intend to support ESI for Varnish 2.0.
Right.
Article edit size includes.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically what Paul Henning was describing, except it's XML-based, and the document that you have to inspect is usually a very, very short XML document, which
mm-hmm.
describes how. It's very important from a marketing point of view, because everybody asks about it. I'm not sure if ESI actually helps performance all that much.
If you can avoid it.
Everything is a balancing act, and ESI will help in situations where you have where certain things are expensive and other things are cheap. And Varnish upsets that balance. Varnish makes things that used to be expensive cheap. And it's quite possible that with Varnish ESI, that the benefit of ESI disappears when you're running Varnish instead of Oracle Web Accelerator or whatever it's called.
That sounds a little bit like what I was thinking. Have something. I mean, the HTTP header will tell you, or
in a properly designed system, whether or not it's an XML
yeah.
request coming in.
Yeah.
And then you could treat that differently than
yes.
Normal.
But anyway, we can cache the fact, just like we cache the fact that an object isn't cacheable, we can cache the fact
mm-hmm.
that an object is an ESI object.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to do content inspection every time we
exactly.
get a request for that object. We have to do it every time that object times out and we have to inspect it from the back
end. I mean, the idea is to build probably some sort of a list
yeah.
that says, to send this object, really what you have to do is you have to send this, this, and this object.
So we translate, we get this ESI XML thing and we translate it into kind of a vector of
yeah. The one kind of content modification that we probably have on our list as well is compression, because bandwidth costs. and with the kind of CPU load we have on Varnish now, I think the majority of web servers, web services will be able to put up any reasonable modern machine, and it will have plenty of CPU to stand there around and compress objects.
Actually, we have
while doing the service,
we have customers with very large websites who have deployed Mondeflate
yep.
on their website. And it turns out that not only do they save bandwidth, but their users get a better browsing experience because their CPU
faster.
Can decompress much faster than they can download the uncompressed.
Yes. That's also why CNN does it. It gives, they have a large front page. And
yes.
compressing it gives a faster experience on the user end.
One of the wet things that Paul Henning was talking about in VCL would be probably if this object is requested 10 times, gzip it.
Yep.
Now you. Because you don't want to gzip the file every time you deliver it.
You don't want to do it when Google comes around to pick up your three-year-old archives. You don't want to waste time. No, I mean, but see, this is the point about VCL. I could sit up, I could make a config option where you could say the number of times it has to blah, 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 blah. And you get a configuration file that nobody would understand 3 years from now, 1 year from now if I get run over by a bus, right? By putting in a language, what I'm doing is I'm delivering a set of tools and you guys get to hook them together and make Varnish do what you want to do. And that will give a level of flexibility that once people start scratching their head over this, they'll kind of say, huh, I can use this too, and things will happen which I haven't even dreamt about.
The thing with the way Squid is configured, it doesn't really let you set policy, it only lets you tune policy parameters, and it's kind of like having a penal code where the only thing you're allowed to change is how long you go to prison for this or that. You're not allowed to add penalties for new crimes or decriminalize something which used to be a crime. No.
I suspect you are moving into a discussion which is better than over a beer.
Yeah.
which discussion is it?
Hey, it's the new mascot.
Oh,
polar bear.
My daughter is going to love this one.
And thank you very much.
Mest sannsynligvis hvis det teknisk går ut og virker, så kommer vi til å switche VM-nett hele veien over på live på denne plassover 2. Da kommer vi til å kjøre hele veien på en datamaskin som jeg kjøpte for 6.900 kroner.
This is really the point. He's a cheapskate.
Stokke, det var ikke sånn video kommer til å kjøpe en datamaskin.
Du overdriver det. Det var prisen på bladet. Det var prisen på bladet. Du har blade chassis i tillegg.
Det er jo ikke så økt, men responstiden for å lese det er jo...
Ja, men det er jo...